New Buffalo cuts off new Airbnb-style rentals. And I'll talk with Cranes reporters Ali Marotti and Steve Daniels about Walgreens' cost-cutting plans and State Farm's rates.
They're just financially incredibly strong. I mean, it's $126 billion of net worth on their balance sheet. They can afford to take 3 years of losses if they wanted to.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist for Monday, November 29th. When it comes to a professional like your doctor or lawyer, you want someone who knows you well. Wintrust believes you should have the same relationship with your banker, someone you can call directly and know they'll understand your concerns. Thousands of local business owners called their Wintrust banker when they needed Paycheck Protection Program loans. They called, Wintrust answered, and helped more than 11,000 local businesses secure funding. Learn more at wintrust.com/dailygist. Member FDIC. All right, I'm joined by Ali Marotti and Steve Daniels for this Reporters Roundtable edition. You both cover an awful lot of stuff. Gosh, between the two of you, you've got a lot of stuff going. Ali, you've recently done some reporting on Walgreens, and Steve on State Farm. Steve, let's start with you. So you've been taking a look at State Farm and what the result that rate cuts have had on policy growth. What can you tell us there?
To start at the beginning, COVID really disrupted the auto insurance industry, and basically for a large number of months, people weren't driving, and so auto insurers experienced a big windfall in profits. And so there was a lot of debate among regulators in the industry about how to share some of that with customers. State Farm, of all of the big ones, and we're talking about State Farm, Progressive, Allstate, and Geico, as anybody who watches television at all knows, because their ads are ubiquitous, was the most aggressive in terms of rate cutting. And they quickly moved to cut rates all in every state in the country by, in most cases, double digits, 11, 12, even 14%. Others acted in the form of temporary rebates and such. So I thought it would be interesting to look at how that manifested itself in terms of growth for State Farm. Because State Farm, the largest auto insurer in the country forever and ever, but is close to losing that battle with Geico and Progressive, both of which are nipping at its heels. And really, it was on a track to lose it as early as next year, maybe 2023, before the pandemic hit. So I thought it would be interesting to see whether they had been able to sort of reverse that slide after cutting rates. And I think the answer to that is yes, at least more in a noticeable way. So I looked at, this, for State Farm, so hard, they're not publicly traded. They don't put out filings that update these sorts of things. So you have to kind of go through state insurance rate filings, which is a little bit of a time-consuming, fairly monotonous, boring task that I did so that others don't have to. And in a number of very large states, you saw some really impressive growth in policies. New York and Michigan were the ones that really stood out. 9% growth in a year-over-year basis, essentially, in what are the fourth and fifth largest auto insurance markets in the country. And Texas, 4% in the space of 7 months, the second largest auto market in the country. So, all of this sort of matters in part, at least within the industry, because all of these rivals, Allstate, Geico, Progressive, are now sharply hiking rates because people are back on the roads. And also they're experiencing substantial inflation in terms of the cost of repairing cars. Essentially, it's tied to the soaring cost of used automobiles, which if you're an insurer, you promise somebody's car is totaled, you promise to replace it. So the cost to you is rising rapidly while your rates are the same or not catching up. So those other companies are trying to catch up with all of that. State Farm thus far has shown little inclination yet to do that. In which case, that's going to make things difficult for those other insurers who also still want to grow. And yet, you've got this price sensitivity on the part of Americans because of inflation, and you also have, you know, the biggest in the land out advertising all the time about their surprisingly great rates, and being able to more or less back it up in a lot of places. So it really kind of demonstrated just how commoditized and price sensitive this business really is, especially if you, you know, cut prices in a way that people notice.
With other insurers starting to hike their rates, is this sort of a let's grab market share while the getting is good and then deal with rates later sort of a play from them?
I think so. You know, they're not publicly traded. They don't have to answer to shareholders. They're technically a mutual insurer that technically is owned by its policyholders. They're just financially incredibly strong. I mean, it's $126 billion of net worth on their balance sheet. They can afford to take 3 years of losses if they wanted to. I don't think they will. But that's always the trick for the others, is that they're answerable to shareholders. They can't sit and take underwriting losses and do nothing for a year or two, in order to protect their market share position. I think in a lot of respects, COVID is the opening for State Farm that, you know, was otherwise well on its way to losing its market share crown to Progressive, Geico, or both. Now they may still very well do that down the line because a lot of the trends that are driving that are still present. I mean, you still have 19,000 State Farm agents all over the country. They get paid, you know, 12-13% each time someone renews their policy, and that's just a cost disadvantage that makes it hard to be price competitive. But for the time being, I do think that's what this has turned out kind of to be for them.
Yeah, exactly. How long will this cushion them?
Yeah, and it matters to them to be number one. You know, I mean, you could ask the question, why do you even care? You're still big. You're still serving a very vast customer base that wants to deal with you and wants to deal with an agent and all. But they do. They care. It matters. And I think this is, at the very least, put off the day of reckoning for a few years or several years. And who knows, maybe it will be something longer lasting.
Yeah, sure. Maybe it'll be a big pivot moment when we look back on it. All right, Ali, let's go to you and talk about Walgreens. So there were some store closures announced in the Bay Area. They cited shoplifting as the reason for that, but that's put the company in quite a position with some local officials and some community groups. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so there's kind of a lot of different things going on here, right? So they announced that move over a month ago, probably. And, you know, it's not unusual for Walgreens to shut down stores. They've shut down something like more than 700 since 2018 across the country as part of a cost-cutting campaigns that they're doing. You know, and they don't really say how they decide which ones are going to shut down. Are they the financially underperforming ones, the non-profitable ones, et cetera? With these ones in particular, there are five, and they just shut down, you know, last week or so. They said that it was not just shoplifting. I think this is an important differentiation to make, but organized retail theft. So that goes beyond someone, you know, coming in and stealing a tube of toothpaste in a magazine and really taking large quantities of items and typically reselling them online somewhere. That's a crime that has become really prolific since the start of the pandemic, for a multitude of reasons. You know, some of it is just because there's more people shopping online, so there's more, you know, availability and possibility to sell stuff to people online. You can do it pretty anonymously and not get caught. This has been pretty well documented. There's a lot of, you know, stories that have been done by the national media kind of chronicling how bad this problem has gotten. But what happened was sort of interesting with Walgreens is that, you know, this decision still sparked all this backlash, and it kind of landed them in the middle of this broader debate about community disinvestment, you know, and racial inequality and all that sort of thing, you know, those sorts of topics that you get into when a company pulls out of a community. Backlash from the mayor of San Francisco, even local media kind of digging into the numbers of the crime reports at these different stores. But, you know, just what I wanted to do was kind of look into what this is going to mean for Walgreens going forward, right? Like, regardless of what the real reasoning was behind those closures, and taking it broader than San Francisco, they still have plans to close another 150 US locations over the next 3 years. So I wanted to look at what it's going to take for them, you know, to make sure that their reputation isn't harmed when they go and close all these stores. Like, how do they need to change their interactions with the community, to make sure that they're not getting themselves involved in this big national debate every single time they close one of these stores down? And it's just really interesting because typically, you know, closing an unprofitable store makes good business sense for a company, especially one like Walgreens that has 9,000 store locations. You know, it ruffles a few feathers in the community, but, you know, these days, consumers are applying greater scrutiny to corporations, particularly when it comes to diversity and inclusion. So I think that's really what's different here and what Walgreens needs to keep in mind.
Right. So it's kind of balancing the, maybe a store is unprofitable, balancing that out with, will this community still have a location to serve it?
Correct. And I think that it's very tough for Walgreens in particular, because they are really trying to, you know, build themselves as a cornerstone in communities, especially now. You know, one of their big growth opportunities and goals that they're looking at is to really formulate themselves more into healthcare destinations. You know, they're going to be putting primary care doctors into, I believe it's 1,000 of the stores by 2027. More than half of those locations are going to be in areas with limited access to such services. So, you know, there's kind of a dichotomy here, and it could become, you know, the optics could be bad, you know, if they're closing down a store in a neighborhood that is underserved, but also saying at the same time, they're going to increase those services. The question is, you know, are they ruffling too many feathers in a community that they may need to be expanding in? You know, just, there's a bunch of different things to think about for them. Experts were telling me. One interesting thing I did is I talked to some residents in the Jeffrey Manor neighborhood, which is sort of by Calumet Heights. There was a Walgreens that closed there in 2019. And I talked to a couple residents, both over the age of 70, that had, you know, prescriptions that they got at that Walgreens. And it was really fascinating because, especially, you know, covering stuff from a business perspective all the time, I think it's important to take a step back and not look just at, is that store profitable? Like, what are the finances of it? But what's the impact in the community? And these people were telling me that, you know, they were kind of shocked, first of all, because the only gauge they have is seeing how busy the store is. And both of them told me, you know, that store was always busy. I don't understand why it wasn't doing well. And they felt like Walgreens was upset with them in some way. You know, they felt like that Walgreens didn't give them as a community a chance to offer more support, go to the Walgreens more. And, you know, it's in an area that had struggled with disinvestment and really felt like they'd been pummeled again and again. The only thing they had left over there, they told me, was, I can't remember if it was a Dollar General or a Dollar Store, but one of those stores, and it was burned down in the lootings in the summer of 2020. So they were telling me that now one of the women just drives to Indiana, which is about a 4 or 5 mile drive, to do all of her shopping, still goes to Walgreens over there. The other one told me that she got her prescriptions transferred to a Jewel Osco, and she no longer shops at Walgreens because they just rubbed her the wrong way and they lost a customer in her, you know? So, but it was rough for them. And I think that that's important. You know, some of these experts I talked to for the story were telling me that when Walgreens looks to go into a community, what they need to do is survey kind of what, not just what role they'll fill, but if they leave, what hole they'll leave when they do that.
The difference between a Walgreens and, say, like, you know, a store selling cell phones or whatever is that it is a destination. I mean, people, particularly older people, I mean, any pharmacy I walk into these days, Walgreens, CVS, or whatever, the lines for prescriptions are crazy.
Oh, yeah. And all the vaccines and, you know, your flu shots, your COVID shots, all of that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. And people, I think, are getting more accustomed to taking care of in the age of COVID, taking care of that stuff at their drugstore than they were before, you know, where they might have used their doctor or a primary care physician or what have you. So it's a really sensitive issue. It's interesting. Be interesting to me, if someone covers banking, that's been an issue because the banks have obviously been closing their branches pretty aggressively in the last several years as people do remote banking much more. But they've generally been very, very careful not to close them in underserved neighborhoods. And in that case, you've got a regulatory apparatus that punishes you if you're a bank, because you're more regulated than a drugstore is, because there are legal standards for serving underserved communities, and having a branch in them is really helps you meet those legal requirements. Wondering if this gets bad enough, whether you might see some kind of response politically along those lines.
Yeah, you brought up a couple of really good points there. You know, first of all, the fact that everybody tries to do all their shopping in one trip during COVID. And I've reported on, you know, grocery stores and convenience stores and that kind of stuff that say that's not going to change. You know, people still want to be able to pop in. If you're going to go pick up your prescription, you want to be able to get, you know, a few basic items too, you know. And that's definitely something that the residents that lost at Walgreens told me that they did. And that was before COVID, you know. The other thing that I think is interesting that you mentioned is the regulatory aspect of this. You know, for Walgreens, I talked to a few analysts and some of them were totally unconcerned with the closings. You know, they were like, this isn't going to affect their bottom line. It's not something that shareholders are really worried about, because if they're closing an underperforming store, you know, to cut their costs and, you know, Walgreens is doing this $1.3 billion cost cutting campaign. So this fits into that. And that's not something that shareholders are going to get upset about. So that was interesting. But you're right. I think there's this bigger debate here if banks, you know, are regulated about it. But a lot of people I spoke with for the story were talking about kind of this debate around whose responsibility is it in an underserved community to provide services? Because Walgreens is not a nonprofit. You know, they may have in their mission or whatever that it, you know, they want to be a community pillar, but how far do they go with that? How much loss do they take? I think for them, you know, I tried to pry and prod them a little bit to get more out of why they were closing these stores and what stores they're going to close in the future. How much is the theft going to play a role in that? The organized retail crime. They wouldn't, you know, answer any of my questions beyond explaining about those 5 stores in San Francisco. And they had seen one of the issues with the organized retail crime is that, you know, number one, it's really traumatizing for the employees that work there, because most retailers tell their employees not to engage, you know, people that are walking out with items for their safety. And then a lot of these retailers are spending a lot more on security in these 5 San Francisco stores. In particular, Walgreens said they were spending 49 times the chain average in those locations on security, and that it wasn't really helping that much. So, you know, it's just one of those things where at what point do you pull the plug? And I don't know what Walgreens' threshold is on that. You know, they wouldn't answer that question. So I think it's something that we're going to see, you know, as they go forward with these closures, how do you weigh? Do they change that weight, you know, that formulation that they use?
This is sort of tangentially tied to what you're looking at. But I mean, just anybody walking into a Walgreens, particularly in the city these days, you see almost everything under lock and key, right? I think we've grown sort of accustomed to it, but yet, it seems like every time I walk in, there's more things under lock and key than there were before, you know, so that essentially you've got to hire all of these, you have to hire enough people so that when I or another customer presses a button, you'll come over relatively quickly and unlock the, you know, deodorant case or whatever. And the cost, if you're going to do that, the cost of hiring all of those people, you start to wonder a little bit about, is that really equal to the cost of theft? I mean, where does this kind of, it's just, there seems to be some sort of this isn't going in the right direction, and where does it end kind of thing.
Right. And for retailers, they've always, you know, for years, they've built in leakage where you build in a little bit of shoplifting to your budgets. But a story just came out today about another big retailer, I think it was Best Buy, that said the theft that's occurring from their stores has gotten so bad that it's eating into their margins. So I think it's when it becomes that bad, you know, you're not making as much money, you know, your profits aren't as high, then you have to figure out something to do. But this is a nationwide problem. I just pulled up the stats here, and According to the National Retail Federation, organized crime costs retailers an average of almost $1 billion in sales. It's an average of $720,000 for every $1 billion in sales. So that's pretty significant. It's only going up. I think I saw a survey recently that 69% of retailers said that they had noticed it increasing over the past year. So I think that'll be interesting. One other thing I wanted to mention about Walgreens too that I think needs to be said, because I am working on an analysis looking at kind of their locations, where they're at, what kind of, you know, what communities are they in, what zip codes, are they underserved, you know, are they majority white, are they minority communities, and I'm not finished with that yet, so I can't conclusively say whether they're closing more stores that are, you know, in communities of color. But I think one thing that we should note is that after, you know, in 2020, a lot of their stores in the south and west sides of Chicago were damaged and looting and some of the unrest that followed George Floyd's murder. And they did end up reopening most of those. And that was a big question that a lot of, you know, media members were watching. Are they going to? Because it took months, you know, over a year, I think, to reopen some of them. And they did. And they were really adamant about that. Like, we're not going to leave these communities. So I think that that is a point that needs to be made, because that is a pretty significant investment to basically rebuild some of those stores that they had to do.
That's another one of those kind of wait and see stories. As we see this cost cutting measure coming out, it's 1.3 billion. We'll have to kind of see where that lands in the company.
Yeah. And they're not the only ones. CVS just announced, you know, a few days ago that they were going to close 900 locations over the next 3 years. So it's not just a Walgreens issue here, you know.
I was just about to mention CVS, like they were kind of pointing towards we're moving in this more digital way. But, you know, that's bottom line stuff, too, for sure. All right. Now is the time where we turn to three stories not on your beat, but that have caught your eye over the last week or so. Who wants to start?
Okay. So the New York Times had a story, and, you know, I think our colleague John Pletz has written about this a little bit too, but the New York Times had a story recently kind of saying that Thanksgiving travel throughout the week and weekend would really be a big tell for airlines, kind of about how the rebound is going to go. So the first big holiday that everybody's kind of for sure most likely getting together with vaccinations and everything, you know, in 2 years. So, There's already been so many reports throughout the summer about unruly passengers. I'm sure everyone's read those stories about how hard it is for flight attendants and just airline officials to keep everybody in check these days. And so this story was really kind of digging into that. Like, this is going to be not just to tell business-wise, like how many people are actually going to fly, but like how unruly are passengers going to get and how are the airlines going to handle them? I thought that was kind of interesting. The other one is sort of on my beat, but it's not something I would write about, which I feel like I'm always bringing these types of things in that are very like my beat tangential. But Popeyes opened its first location in Britain. And again, the New York Times did this really great story about it because they, I guess, had these problems where, you know, British people didn't know what kind of biscuit, like what a biscuit, an American biscuit was, because in British English, a biscuit is a cookie. So they were like, what is this? This is not a biscuit. This looks like a scone, but it doesn't taste like a scone. And why is it being served with fried chicken? So that was just a really funny story kind of about how when you know, chains like this open up a new spot around the world, they have to deal with some of these cultural differences. And what do you do? And they ended up, Popeyes said that they did a focus group and they knew that the biscuit thing was going to be an issue. But in the end, they decided to run with it because they thought that, you know, keeping to the Louisiana roots would be good for them because everybody knows that's where great fried chicken comes from. So I found that one to be really interesting. And then the other thing that I'm keeping an eye on is just sort of the news came out recently that, you know, the jury decision in Cleveland found that Walgreens, Walmart, and CVS had sustained the opioid crisis. And, you know, it looks like that may set some sort of precedent, just seeing if there are other counties around the country that sue over that. And I think it'll be interesting to see what the compensation claims, you know, will end up being.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting story, too. Steve, what about you? What caught your eye this week?
Well, nothing that has to do with business.
We usually talk about animals, so this is already a deviation.
The first one was the news, the Washington Post, the story they did on the coach of the Red Stars, the Chicago women's soccer team, resigning and right after they'd been in the final. They lost the final, but it had, by all accounts, a very successful year. And he then suddenly resigns, and it was kind of bizarre, and nobody understood why. Well, it was because he had been the subject of abuse charges by a number of members of his former and current members of his squad. Generally, the abuse taking the form of yelling, humiliation, that kind of stuff, as opposed to, it wasn't sexual abuse stuff. But yet another instance in the Chicago sports franchise, the Blackhawks, of course, being the other, in which, and I should add that this had been covered up for now several years. I mean, the owner of the team was aware of it. There had been the whistle was blown on him some, you know, 4 years ago. And, you know, he's a very successful, highly regarded coach within women's soccer. And yet another instance in which a sports franchise sat on information that anybody who could have had any foresight would recognize was eventually going to come back and haunt them or be brought into the open. You know, clearly we've got the beginnings of just a real reckoning within professional sports about how much leeway coaches have, and other leaders of teams and franchises have to run their teams and if, you know, people are doing stuff they shouldn't be doing within their ranks, do something about it. So that's the first one. The other two are more fun than that. So I just started reading, I haven't actually finished this, but New York Times has a long magazine style piece on Miyazaki, the great Japanese animation director, who is apparently coming out of retirement. He has his old studio, Studio Ghibli, that makes these amazing movies, works of art. I mean, I think they're works of art. Spirited Away is probably one of the best known. Disney did English language versions of these. But anyway, he's coming out of retirement at age 80 to direct one last movie. And wow, I can't wait for that. So and I can't wait to finish reading this story either, because he's just an amazing person in the world. And then the last one was as somebody who's a big music fan and a habitual Spotify user, I enjoyed Adele forcing them to make it so that you could listen to a whole album in its running order. It's kind of ridiculous that you can't do that. I mean, why not? I mean, the album is not the art form that it once was in terms of, you know, it's really important to listen to the sequencing of the tracks. And we live in a day and an age when, you know, people are making their own playlists and picking out songs that they like, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Adele has got enough clout that she could just, you know, go to them and say, no, this is not how I want this to be. And they responded. So I think it's more than just her album. I hope it is, but I think so. You're going to be able to listen to albums as the artists intended you to listen to them. And for those of us old enough, as we had to back in the day when we had records that we had to put needles on. So I just thought that was awesome.
She went up against Ticketmaster too, like 5 or 6 years ago when she was going on tour, because she was like, I don't want bots to buy all of my concert tickets. I want my real fans to get them. So you had to do the thing where you got online and waited in line, you know, right when they went on sale and all that kind of stuff. And it was impossible to get tickets. I tried and failed.
Yes. Yeah. It's not like you really have much of it. I've done that any number of times myself, and yeah, it's a real crapshoot. But the Spotify is like, you know, but that's really going to, that's the regular person, right? I mean, that's how they're listening to music. Tons and tons of people.
I just love when big stars like that use their powers for good.
That's right.
Proof of her queenship, that she's like, I'm sorry, that's not how we're going to do this. And they're like, yeah, you're right. Okay.
Even bigger than Taylor Swift, right? She's the other one who forces people to do things that, or strikes back at things that are done to her. Those two women, applause as far as music fans go.
I mean, I feel like throw Beyonce in there, you've got like, what can't you do with those three? You can accomplish pretty much everything. Yeah, that was on my list. I also, there was a really interesting piece in Digiday about publishers, like magazine publishers, news organizations that are introducing pretty successfully product box, like subscription programs, like InStyle has one, things like that. It was just a really interesting look at just all these different products that organizations that you would think only you come to for stories, they're doing so much more and kind of diversifying their revenue. And then also, I continue to be fascinated with all the ways that supply chain woes impact every single thing. I thought it was very interesting. The jellied cranberry would be more difficult to find this Thanksgiving than in years past due to not the cranberry, but the cans.
I missed that. Yeah, of course, because the cans
I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's most, I think if people took a secret vote in America, you would have overwhelming support for the canned cranberry over real cranberries.
I make it myself every year. That's my thing. That's my jam. It's cranberries, fresh cranberries, oranges, a little bit of cinnamon. It's perfect. Mm. It's good on pies.
That does sound good.
All the Thanksgiving hits. It's good on ice cream later.
I had some homemade cranberry sauce for the first time the other day, and it was delicious. And I was like,
I got you. The Amy Guth Cranberry Express coming through. Here we go. Appreciate talking to both of you, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, it was fun.
Thank you.
Coming up, RV rental company Outdoorsy is in talks with Rivian and Ford for a $100 million electric vehicle order to build out its fleet. We'll talk about that and more right after this. Is your student taking the SAT, ACT, or a high school admissions test this year? Academic Approach wants to help them get prepared. Academic Approach's time-tested tutoring programs ensure students grow their academic skills, improving their performance on standardized tests. The work together begins with a consultation with an Academic Approach director who will meet with you and your student to discuss their unique needs. Then Academic Approach creates an effective, fully customized study plan that targets their goals and matches them with a tutor who will be by their side, guiding them through instruction and practice throughout their tutoring journey. Get in touch today to learn how Academic Approach can help your student transform into a confident, successful test taker. Learn more at academicapproach.com/dailygist.
This is the Crane's Daily Gist with Amy Guth.
The city council in New Buffalo voted last Monday to ban new short-term rentals in most of the town, the culmination of a sometimes contentious struggle over Airbnb-style rentals. Crane's residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin reports that the three council members who were present voted unanimously to adopt an ordinance that'll ban permits for new short-term rentals in areas zoned for residential use, which is most of the 2.5 square mile town. New permits will be allowed only in areas that are zoned for commercial use but that contain dwelling units. Short-term rentals through Airbnb and other sites like it have been increasing for years in New Buffalo, a town of about 1,700 full-time residents. City officials estimate that there are about 200 rentals now, both those operating with city permits issued before a moratorium went into effect in May of 2020, and those operating without permits. New Buffalo Mayor John Humphrey, who was elected in 2020 in part because of his outspoken opposition to short-term rentals, said at Monday's meeting that short-term rentals now constitute about one out of every 11 homes in town. He and others have complained about short-term renters bringing noise, litter, and a lack of neighborly respect. They also said home prices have risen fast because of buyers counting on the cash flow, which pushes affordability out of reach for full-time homeowners. However, at Monday's meeting, several owners of second homes urged the city council to reject the ordinance, calling it a blunt instrument not backed by data, and that stopping the growth of short-term rentals is a public relations nightmare for a town whose largest industry is tourism. Others said that it was inequitable to remove the possibility of generating income with their homes. In any event, the past ordinance includes a requirement that city officials evaluate its impact by November 1st of 2022 and determine whether it should be amended. Healthcare management consultant Vizient signed a lease at the old post office building, a move that will combine its local offices into a single location and cut Uber's footprint at the redeveloped building by more than 20%. Vizient signed the deal this month for roughly 112,000 square feet in the property, according to sources familiar with the lease who spoke with Cranes. Vizient plans to consolidate its local offices in the building from roughly 150,000 square feet of combined workspace in the West Loop and in North Suburban Skokie. Irving, Texas-based Vizient, which offers various consulting services to health systems and has the two existing local offices as the result of previous mergers and acquisitions, plans to move into the new space on the old post office's eighth floor late next year, that according to a statement. Vizient Chief People Officer Colleen Risk said in the statement that the company is planning a hybrid work environment, giving workers the option to work from home or the office, and that having the office downtown as opposed to the suburbs will help with worker recruitment and retention. The old post office was more than 90% leased as of last month, according to leasing brokerage Telos Group, which also recently signed a deal on behalf of 601W with Milwaukee Tool for 70,000 square feet in the building. Deering Company's financial outlook for the next year signals that global supply chain delays and high labor costs following a month-long strike won't significantly dent profits at the world's largest maker of agricultural equipment. Moline-based Deere said Wednesday in a statement that it expects record net income for fiscal 2022 of between $6.5 billion and $7 billion, compared to the average estimate of $6.66 billion by 17 analysts. The company posted fourth-quarter profit that topped analysts' estimates, though revenue for the period fell short of expectations for the first time in more than 2 years. The company's upbeat outlook comes despite the labor strike that slowed Deere's factory output of equipment during the busiest farming season of the year. Workers initially rejected two labor contracts before finally approving a third deal just over a week ago. Net income for fiscal 2021 reached $5.96 billion, its highest ever for the company. And those record earnings were part of the reason that workers went on strike, arguing they risked their lives as essential workers during the pandemic and that they had worked with the company to take pay cuts in prior contracts when times were leaner for Deere's profits. Still, strong demand for crops like corn, soybeans, and wheat is driving agricultural prices to the highest in years, creating more profit for farmers to buy new equipment. RV rental company Outdoorsy is in talks with Rivian and Ford to order $100 million in electric trucks and SUVs over the next few years in order to build out its fleet. Outdoorsy CEO Jeff Cavins said the company's aiming to order roughly 1,000 Rivian trucks to add to its platform for renters and employees. He described the two companies' collaboration as a logical and organic alignment, given Outdoorsy's focus on nature and camping, but said delivery of the trucks wouldn't happen until 2023 if Rivian accepts the offer. He later added in a statement that Outdoorsy is also talking with Ford about fulfilling part of its order. Ford recently said it was dropping plans to develop an electric vehicle with Rivian, in which the legacy automaker has a 12% stake. Rivian shares fell about 16% last Monday in New York, while Ford gained 3.3%. Rivian, which listed on the NASDAQ earlier this month, currently has more than 55,000 pre-orders according to regulatory filings and is targeting production of just over 1,300 vehicles a week. That's Crane's Daily Gist for now. Check in on our continuous news feed at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to both of today's guests, Crane's reporters Ali Marotti and Steve Daniels. You can follow all of our conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your audio on demand. And remember to rate and review Crane's Daily Gist because that's the best way for others to discover our episodes. You'll also find hashtag Crane's Daily Gist on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.
I'm A.D. Quigg, host of the Cranes podcast, A.D. Q&A. This week, I sit down with Deputy Mayor Samir Mayakar to talk about the city's five casino bidders, how corporate Chicago is responding to crime, and how the city plans to help Loop buildings adapt in a post-COVID real estate market. You can find it wherever you subscribe to podcasts and at chicagobusiness.com.
So I think what you can expect to see is how we can make strategic investments broadly in the museum campus, but do so in a way that protects the taxpayer.
So some of what us at Cranes are hearing, and you could tell me if I'm off base, naming rights, a jumbotron, new seats, and of course, as BEZ has reported, sportsbook. Am I off base? Is that what the Bears want?
Well, I think, you know, that's all been discussed in public reporting. And, you know, I think that's on the menu of most teams. What I would say is, what's important in this is, besides recognizing the strategic location of Soldier Field, we have a duty to protect the taxpayer, and that's vital.